Hello and welcome to the Geek and Review Podcast. I'm Jeremy Papps, alongside, as always, a man who wishes he were an indie. Hooray, hooray, Mr. Russell Jones. Russell.
Man, indie life is a good life.
It is. Almost like thug life, but...
Almost like thugging.
But in Indiana.
Yep.
And with nerds.
Oh, to be a Hoosier.
What's up, man?
Oh, good stuff, actually. Lots of good stuff. We've got so many games going right now. Mm-hmm. We've got our D&D next game, another D&D next game. The Edge of the Empire game was really good this week.
Mm-hmm.
And Gen Con is going on top of that. I actually have a little bit of swag coming my way from a friend of ours, Penguin, Josh Rowell, who is out there right now for us. So, yeah, other than that, just kind of looking at all the really, really cool stuff that's coming out of Gen Con and geeking the crap out about the ships coming out for X-Wing. Oh, my God. If you haven't seen those yet, we'll have a link up on the podcast page, I assume. But, oof, it's going to be some interesting stuff for X-Wing in the next year.
Yeah, it's that's one thing that has really, at least, I know a lot of people are really interested in it, based partly on the fact that the tabletop podcast from Geek and Sundry for X-Wing just came out, and it was really well received. I know it's been viewed several times, to put it mildly. And I know that Fantasy Flight is enjoying the fruits of those labors, which is really good for them. I think they do some good stuff. And, next week's tabletop is actually a game that we've played called Lords of Waterdeep.
Oh, yeah, they're doing Lords. Yeah, that definitely.
Yeah.
Also, really, really big news on that we're going to talk about that in a minute.
Mm-hmm. But first, another big part that sort of happens around the same time Gen Con does is the Innie Awards, which is a big deal in the industry. It's sort of like the Oscars for gaming nerds. There's some really interesting wins, I think.
Yeah, you also, when we're talking tabletop, they actually won the Emmy for Best Podcast, the Gold Emmy, mm-hmm. for their Dragon Age episodes, which were really, really well done. They had good people involved, besides obviously Will Wheaton, you had Chris Hardwick, and you had Nerdist Podcast. I think Chris Paramus, who actually wrote the adventure and is involved in Green Ronin pretty heavily, he was the DM for them. It's just really, it was a really good couple of episodes that mm-hmm. that showed the Dragon Age tabletop really well and made me interested in playing, or at least, you know, showed them enough of the mechanics that I kind of wanted to steal some of them and use them in my other games. Like I tend to do with every RPG. It's like, okay, this is a new RPG, you say. Let me look at it a little bit. I'm going to cut this piece off. I'm going to dissect that mechanic out. I'm going to steal this and use it over there. And essentially, I take the entire game apart and put it in my toolbox. Because that's just the way I think.
Yeah.
But because they did Dragon Age, you've had a call for a lot of people that are like, oh, why can't you show Pathfinder? Why can't you show these other RPGs? So I know Will's been kind of talking about that on his Not the Flog entries to the podcast. So if you enjoy watching tabletop... keep a lookout for stuff like that. You might see more of it in the future, especially after this.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's fair to say that tabletop is sort of the runaway success from Geek and Sundry. I know that Co-Optitude, which just recently started, is getting some buzz too. Mostly negative, at least at first, when Felicia and her brother play a game and react to it like an adult would react to it, and everyone who played the game when they were kids and reacted to it the way a kid reacted to it lose their freaking mind. I think they played Sonic 2 and didn't really care for it, and the internet like exploded about how wrong they were.
It's the thing, if you're watching this to say, oh, they didn't like this game, you're not watching it for the correct reason.
It's not a review of the game.
Yes, there is a wrong way to watch it, and you're doing it.
People don't understand that it's not a review of the game.
No.
The two people who are funny, I think, I'll say, I think Aaron is even funnier than his sister. I don't know where he came from or what his background in any of this is, but...
Is it Ryan?
Yeah, Ryan. Is that Aaron? God, what is wrong with me? Ryon, R-Y-O-N, or R-A-Y-O-N. No, that'd be Rayon.
Rayon Day.
He's very funny. And you call it nepotism, I guess, but he's a good addition to the team. And it's very funny, but people watch it and they expect when they're playing it that they're just going to go ooh and ah and how awesome these games are, just like they did when they were kids. Well, that's not what it's for, except with, of course, the Bomberman episode. I knew immediately that they were going to love Bomberman because it's so difficult not to.
Yeah.
Because for my money, Bomberman may be one of the best just pure gaming experiences you can have as at any age, just because it combines explosions and strategy and the ability to just completely fuck yourself in hilarious and terrible ways. I knew they were going to love Bomberman, and I was right. By the end of it, they were calling it one of the best games ever, which is true. So, you know, Geek & Sundry just recently sort of revamped everything that they're doing. They've added a lot more as far as video bloggers are concerned and things like that. I haven't gotten a chance to look through all of them, but I will. I know they've also taken on some existing video blogs. One that I saw that popped up yesterday was a series called On the Table. Mm-hmm. And they've picked it up. It's apparently their sixth season, and they've picked it up at episode one of the sixth season. And it's very, and it appears to me to be a tabletop game review, less like tabletop and more like this is a review. I think the one episode they've posted, they're playing Battlestar Galactica.
I'm gonna have to go find that because I love me some Battlestar Galactica,
which as we have played with Adam and Macy.
Yep.
Lots of fun,
but also not exactly the greatest candidate for tabletop in and of itself.
Right, because it just doesn't fit the format. Tabletop is more of a show, and you kind of have
it's
to
the
create
celebrity.
It.
It's the celebrity poker which was the whole concept behind it. It's the celebrity poker of board gaming, and they want to show off certain games. And again, I will say, if you're like, well, why do they do this? Why don't they do this? In between, because this was season two, I think, for Geek & Sundry, mm-hmm. It was where you saw all the stuff coming in. In between those, Will Wheaton did about three or four, not the vlogs, filling in for Felicia. And he explained a lot about, you know, I can't do these games, and these are the reasons why they don't fit the good format. And he talks a lot about the TV making side of it, which is, as a TV person, it's very important, and I picked up on that stuff. I was like, oh yeah, it wouldn't be good for these reasons. And to hear him talk about it, it's like, ah, see, I told you.
Yeah.
So watch those, because he also recommends lists and lists of games that, you know, he's like, I wish I could do these, and he rattles off like six games and says, and they're cool because, and he rattles off a lot of reasons why you should play them, but, you know, we just can't do them.
Right.
Having that, and it makes a lot of sense to have the other On the Table podcast come in so that they can actually do a, you know, here's a way that we can talk about these games that does, even though it doesn't fit the format of tabletop. And I would be really interested to see how much they expand, because tabletop has been so successful, how much they kind of expand that aspect of the channel. I've also been watching Outlands, which just launched. I think it's Outlands. Two episodes are out now. It's kind of like, you remember Code Monkeys?
Yes.
It's very similar to that. It's that same kind of 8-bit-ish style, that kind of humor. It's funny. It's actually pretty good. It's worth you know, watching for a little bit.
Yeah, I haven't had an opportunity to watch through it, but that's the great thing about the internet, is you can go and do it right now.
Yep.
So let's get back to the Innie Awards. Some things that sort of caught our mutual eye. The best website went to Gnome Stew, which is a great website. If you have never, if you've never popped in, you absolutely should. It's especially if you run or play any sort of tabletop games, which seems obvious, but it's geared more toward DMs and GMs of games, and it gives you a lot of really great resources, a lot of great tips, and some cheats that you can use to really push your game forward. And it's a good thing for any GM to really take a look at. Second was The Escapist, which is it kind of surprises me because I
don't
really
list the Escapist as a website.
Because I don't really well, hang on. It's The Escapist, not Escapist.
Not Escapist, yeah.
Right. It's The Escapist.
Which I think is, I'm sure that that's probably caused quite a bit of like, wait.
Yeah, I was thinking I was a bit the, but Escapist is a video game website.
Largely, they do cover other
but primarily it's mostly video game stuff, and I know that the innies like to stay very specifically tabletop and RPG style games, but The Escapist is a completely different thing, which I'd never seen, but now I will check out because they won a silver innie. Also, something we were playing with before we got on the podcast recently, we started up a D&D Next playtest. And Russell was running through the gold winner for best software, which is called Roll20. And Roll20 is an app for Google Hangouts in addition to a community website sort of deal.
Yeah, they actually it's a web-based set of tools to run games online. And you don't actually even need Google Plus to do it. It just lets you also use Google Plus. Mm. You can actually run everything for Roll20, which is a virtual tabletop, through Roll20's website. It has video chat. It has sound, you know, audio chat. So you can actually make a community hub around that. I kind of liken it. It's very similar to Obsidian Portal. Mm-hmm. And that Obsidian Portal lets you build an entire campaign and Wikipedias with all these rich resources and maps and everything else. And your players can load their characters on Obsidian 20. And that makes a great resource for a campaign to kind of go around. Roll 20 takes the other side of it and takes the gaming experience and creates a rich set of online tools to be able to do that online. And we have certainly found that playing online as... just, you know, from a Google Hangouts perspective, mm-hmm. whether you're doing it over Skype, whether you're doing it in a couple of the different ways, playing online, it quickly becomes the easiest way to solve all those problems that you tend to run into from scheduling, from getting the right mm-hmm. people together, from getting everyone together in the same place at the same time, solving the problem of, well, how am I going to fit five people around my table in my little tiny apartment? You know, there are certain games where, especially after using the Roll20 tools, part of me is like, I really wish that I could use these tools in some of my in the games that I have played with people around an actual table. It's that good.
Yeah, it's good.
Especially from a mapping perspective. And let me kind of run you through what we've run into. We're running Shackled City
mm-hmm.
with D&D Next rules. And because Shackled City has been out for as long as it has, there's a lot of maps online. Which I know, looking at you, my players are not downloading ahead of time.
No.
Reviewing. But you can take the map as a GM, just drag and drop it into the interface for Roll20. It loads the map behind the grid, which the software has to have to be able to place minis and things like that. And then you can resize it and align it so that your map in the background matches that grid. And then the players come in, you have tokens. As a DM, you can build the fog of war so that they can't see the rest of the map. You can highlight and reveal certain sections of the map. And we were just messing around on Google Plus because it has a plugin that lets you load it into Google Plus if you're used to doing that, and it worked flawlessly. It's going to be an amazing resource, especially considering the detail that goes into Shackled City and the maps that are created. So. Just after playing with it for like a half hour to an hour, I'm really looking forward to it. And it's got, you know, a great community tools in it. If you need tokens, then you can go search the art database for tokens. If you need maps, you can do the same thing and just drag and drop them into your game. You can highlight them so that they show up later as a favorite if you want to keep using the same thing over and over.
Mm-hmm.
These include, if you want, representations of the actual little round cardboard tokens that... people have made, you can do that. Some people have just gone in and photoshopped art so that it has that little round circular token format and loaded those into the community. Some have actually made what looks like top-down representations of actual dwarves or dragons or goblins, and you can drop those in if you want that custom artwork. They've also got sound files that you can load into a jukebox as a DM, adjust the audio, put them on a loop. So if you want kind of a background sound, we talked a bit about a Kickstarter that was being done for a, I think like True Sound or True Dungeon Sound. that looked like it was going to be incredible. And they have something similar just as a kind of background thing. So you can have sound effects going on. You can have your tokens and keep track of how much hit points they have and put little flags on them that everyone can see. It's just so many little things in the interface that are really awesome. Like there's a ruler rangefinder where you can click it and drag across the map, and it'll tell you from the square you clicked on to this square that you're hovering over, it's 30 feet. And you just like, I didn't even know I wanted that, but that's awesome, you know? And that's the sign of a really, really good set of tools.
It's definitely clear that the makers of Roll20 knew what they were trying to create before they created it, have created that, and are now essentially playing, going, oh, that would be really cool to have in the thing, and then putting it in there. It's clear that they've taken a lot, because you get a lot of that, I didn't even know that I wanted that, but that's great, yep, sort of things, and it's not stuff that feels tacked on, like, this would be fine. It's stuff that you don't see and you go, oh, that's cool, you see and go, oh, I'm really going to use that.
Yep.
And it's made to take as much time to use as you want to spend using it. There aren't a lot of interfaces and menus and things you have to go through. For instance, indicating that your character has been poisoned. It's a little box that's just already there.
You click it, you put a little skull crossbones on.
And
you click
it in
these,
and it's not in, it doesn't
interfere
with anything.
Or you pick a little green dot.
Yeah, or whatever you want to do. And it gives you all these different options for doing the same thing instead of telling you, well, when your character dies, click die and we'll take the token off the thing. It allows you to, you can X him out. You could put a little skull and crossbones over him to show that he's dead. You could just remove the token entirely if that's what you want to do. That's the mark of a tool. A long time ago, right when 4th edition was just coming out, D&D was talking about their virtual tabletop. And that was one of the big selling points of 4th edition. Anyone who wants to complain about 4th edition, because I am a 4th edition fan, anyone who wants to complain about 4th edition will get absolutely no pushback from me when it comes to what we were sold from the digital tools standpoint to what we received. If you look back at what they were talking about having and what we ended up with, it's pretty stark.
It was a mess.
It was a hot mess. It was an absolute dumpster fire. Yeah. And it really just, it was not good. They attempted a virtual tabletop, which we played around with quite a bit. And it never got past a confusing oddity.
Yeah.
Just not a moment past just a confusing, just mess. The character creator was pretty good, but it was very regimented. You had very specific things you had to do, and it was good for creating very base characters. It was good for creating characters using all rules as written, but if you wanted to do a couple of tweaks here and there, if you as a DM wanted to give someone a language or something they couldn't otherwise get, you couldn't really do that. It was just very regimented.
And that seemed to be a big problem from the core concept standpoint of let's incorporate all these elements of the character sheet into this, and that seemed like a ton of information to try to figure out and to also have to develop for
and sift through.
Yes.
I mean, when you're looking at, there wasn't something very simple for them to do would have been to have a selector for your campaign setting. We're going to play an Eberron campaign setting. I'm going to click Eberron. And then that would move every Eberron-specific option to the top and highlight it or make it gold or whatever. That would have made the character creator 10 times better. Because you go to languages and you know that there are Eberron-specific languages that you can grab and use and you might want to grab and use. You still have access to all the other ones, but it's still there. All the backgrounds and feats that were from the books, you had to sift through all of them. And it worked. We used it. It created some, I will say this, it created some really nice looking character sheets.
Yeah.
They were very, you know, you had your cards and it was just very nice. But it never really got out of that realm. Yeah. And this we were paying for.
Yeah. And the character creator that became part of the digital tool set was not a slouch, considering that they tried to do a character creator in third edition when the books first launched, and they had the CD in the back of the book. Remember when we had to get our software because they attached a little CD in the back of the book? Remember those times? You remember those times?
I do.
We had that, and that was more or less, you know, decent. It helped, I think, get a lot of concepts understood and helped you do some math, but it was still kind of slightly problematic, especially if you tried to do anything special.
Mm-hmm.
The tool set for 4th edition helped take all the different pieces of information you had to pull together for your character and put them all in one place and make them easy to, you know, collate and bring together and to also kind of troubleshoot, oh, why am I not getting, oh, here it is. So there's at least that.
Yeah, it wasn't bad. We used the shit out of it. Don't get me wrong.
But as far as a tabletop, actual virtual tabletop, it just seems like every edition they've tried to do a digital tool set and something has gone horribly, flamingly wrong. And in this case, it was the tabletop. And they eventually just stopped iterating altogether.
Yeah, they just stopped it.
It's probably for the best.
Yeah.
And now, Roll20.
Roll20, I hazard to say they've gotten it right. We played with it for what? A half hour?
Just kind of messing around
with
it.
Just sort of fucking around with it. We played with it for probably a half hour. And, I mean, we were ready to play a game.
Yeah.
Completely ready to play a game.
Yeah.
I mean, Russell imported the maps and put the things in there, and they were digging around with the music, and I was drawing cones, and we were ready to play a game. It was a dragon.
Yeah.
I mean, it was a dungeon, and there was a dragon in it.
We were playing with the fog of war.
Right.
And I'm like, hey, Jeremy, open that door, and he moved over to one of the doors, and I highlighted the area that I wanted to reveal, and it revealed the room on the other side. There's a huge dragon. He's like, close the door!
Yeah, so it just got it right. You know, going to the end of the thing that really stuck out to me is going to the end of a hallway and saying, well, I peek around the corner, and you see a line of what the character sees.
Yeah, and stretched all the way across.
But you get halfway through and you realize, oh, there's a room there.
Yeah, that's the thing that I like about the Fog of War, the way that it's done, is that you can help simulate what do I see and what information do I have to make choices with.
And it looked sexy.
Yes, it did.
It is sexy. So if you're attempting to play anything, we're even talking about using it for the Star Wars game.
Oh, yeah.
Which I've gotten I've sort of gotten used to playing without having a good... Because I'm a map and minis kind of guy. I like a map and minis. I do. I just do. And I miss it sometimes on the Star Wars game when I have to go, well, how far away am I? Well, medium distance. What the fuck? Well, I'm really close to this guy, right? No, you're medium distance from him, too. Where am I?
Yeah, it's
I have no clue where I am.
Because the DM has certain things in his head, and it is the DM's responsibility, if you're doing Theater of the Mind, to help describe where those people are. And the social contract requires everyone around the table when you're doing Theater of the Mind to admit, okay, the DM has the final say in where everything is, And it can create that frustration, especially if you're a melee character and positioning is incredibly important.
Yes, positioning is everything. I can't.
If you're a melee character in a blaster heavy game, I'm just an axe kind of guy in a blaster world.
So, and it's a little frustrating, and there's really no time to tell everyone exactly where they are because you have four people, and that would be the majority of combat. Going, well, you're here and here, and this guy's here and this guy's here. Nor that we would even be paying attention to that. So I miss doing minis to a certain degree in Star Wars. Not a huge thing, but since we've started up the playtest for D&D Next. We have used minis, though it was on a physical mat that Russell actually had minis on, which worked okay.
I had to suspend my camera from a lamp over the mat.
Yeah, which just doesn't work very well.
And there's the question of, hey, can you tell what mini this is?
Yeah.
Is that the kind of orangey-shaped blob, or is it the blonde-looking goblin?
Right, and with the blonde-looking goblin. Yeah. And with, I think I dated one of those once. Sorry. with Roll20, not only... Here's the thing I'm going to say about Roll20, which you won't hear. It's better than a physical map. Because sometimes, in our party, we have two gnomes, potentially three. I know you're saying to yourself right now, really? And you haven't killed all three of them? We've only played once, so don't rule that out. But if we're going to have three, potentially, gnomes on the table... you're going to get a little confused as to which gnome is which, which one's the wizard, which one's the rogue, which one's the whatever the, which one's the cleric. You're going to get a little confused as to which one is which. You can just put nameplates above the token.
If you said, well, it's because all gnomes just look alike to me.
All gnomes do look alike. That makes me racist.
That's speciesist.
But I'm a dwarf, so I can be speciesist. But, I mean, it's nice just, you could just put something as simple as putting a nameplate above a character. So instead of me saying, I want to give Jim this. Well, Jim's character's name isn't Jim. Jim's character name is something else. So I always, I don't know if you ever, I know in our Star Wars game, you have certain people who call the other, who call people by characters. I have certain players I'll call by their character, and certain people I'll call by their name.
Yeah.
With something like Roll 20, just having the nameplates there, I can look at the nameplate and go, I'm going to give Roberto Goldfinger this thing. Oh, okay, well, thank you, says Roberto Goldfinger's player Bob.
Roberto Fiasco. He's the Carlos Danger of gnomes.
Roberto Fiasco. Now that has to be used somewhere.
I have to have an NPC named Roberto Fiasco. It is going to happen. He's going to be a current character, and it's going to happen.
John Oliver's stint on The Daily Show is over as of Thursday, but when you said Carlos Danger, that was what popped my head.
Danger!
So
He has been fantastic.
Yeah, he really has. And it's funny, he's made, because you know he's behind, I get the feeling, he's behind a lot of the ribbing that he's been getting, because people have come out and said, when's John coming back? This has been a dark, dark day in Daily Show history, and you've single-handedly destroyed The Daily Show, and boy, he's been a fantastic host. If Comedy Central doesn't give him his own show, they are woefully out of their league, and he'll get, if it were me, to be perfectly blunt, and I owned another, like a USA or an FX, didn't give him another show, I would try and snipe him and make my own Daily Show sort of cut off. Yeah. And I think FX, they have a show called it's hosted by W. Kamau Bell. I'm trying to remember the name of it. I can't remember it, though. But it's a similar sort of show. And they've also got Russell Brand's talk show on there now, too. If he doesn't get his own show...
Here's the thing. He's actually behind a whole lot of stuff, because he's like the head writer.
Yeah,
so he's behind a whole lot of what you've been seeing on The Daily Show for a long time, and which is why he's able to move into the role so well, is because, you know, he's the one that's crafting a lot of it.
He's also just a very talented performer. If you've never listened to his podcast, The Bugle, you absolutely should.
Yeah, and I honestly think that you're not likely going to see John Oliver take over another show or go off and have his own show. I think you're going to see John Oliver take over The Daily Show, because Jon Stewart is probably going to retire from that sooner rather than later.
That's what a lot of people are thinking.
Just because The Daily Show to Jon Stewart has been like the aging process of the presidency to anyone that holds the office.
Right.
You know? And, I mean... You've seen what's come out of it. You've seen Colbert kind of do his own thing. I don't necessarily think we're going to see a Colbert rapport style with John Oliver. Mm-hmm. I think we're going to see John Oliver take over The Daily Show.
I think that's possible. I don't know if Stewart is ready to let it go quite yet. I think he still has some years in him, which makes me think, you know. And I think John's contract, I've heard, I can't believe I know this, I've heard his contract is through Indecision 2016.
Yeah. And, you know, that's the kind of stuff that we as TV people tend to think about.
Yeah. But it's been great. If you get the opportunity, if you didn't watch a whole lot of it, which you absolutely should have, but if you didn't get to watch a whole lot of it, you should totally pick it up and take a look on the web, especially anything he does with Anthony Weiner, a.k.a. Carlos Danger. Yeah, it's pretty good. So,
while we geeked out about The Daily Show.
Yeah, back to the meanwhile, back on the podcast. The rest of it has been really good. The rest of the innies are pretty interesting. You see a lot from Paizo, which is understood.
Yeah.
The Kobold Guide to World Building got gold for best writing, which does not surprise me.
No, especially knowing if you've those read,
guys. Yeah.
Yeah, like I've read the Kobold Guide. I've got the Kobold Guide over here to like making your own game. I can't remember.
Right.
It's all off the top of my head. But it's just reading it and reading the collection, you know, Wolfgang knows a crap ton of people, and he's very good at bringing them together.
I'll read the Kobold Guide to World Building is a collection of essays. These essays are written by Wolfgang, Keith Baker, Monty Cook, Zeb Cook, Jeff Grubb, Scott Hungerford, Chris Paramus, Jonathan Roberts, Michael Stackpole, Steve Winter, and an introduction by Ken Scholes. I know most of those people.
Yeah.
And not personally, but I recognize most of those people based solely on their work in other, you know, avenues that have been very, very successful. I mean, that's like getting a book of short stories together and having, you know,
Joe Hill.
Yeah, Stephen King and the superstars of
Neil Gaiman
of writing together all in one thing. It's basically what this is. So they have Oscar bait as far as movies are concerned. I think Guide to World Building was kind of any bait. I think so. But it's, I mean, you can get it for $20 on the Kobold website. And those folks are really good people. So you should do that. Of course, we looked through it, and as you might have, again, this podcast is not sponsored by Fantasy Flight Games or Star Wars: Edge of the Empire. We just really like it.
Yes.
It's a lot of fun. So we had noticed that there was Edge of the Empire wasn't represented. 13th Age, which we're also big fans of, wasn't mentioned. Yeah. Those all technically came out after the deadline. So yes. Next year's innies will be really, really, really seriously taking a look at that whole thing. I think you'll see, not to be a Fantasy Flight fanboy, but I think you'll see a lot of Fantasy Flight next year because they have Star Wars X-Wing, which we talked about, which is doing fantastically well.
Yeah.
And I Edge of the Empire, I mean, we cheerlead it for a reason. It is, I would say without a doubt, the best Star Wars tabletop role-playing experience ever, bar none.
And I read and had some of the West End Games Star Wars stuff way back when. Mm-hmm. And I've read through quite a bit of the D20 stuff. And I just really like this system because it is different in a way that you really haven't seen. I know that the central dice mechanics are built off of something that I think they used for Warhammer relatively recently. But it's just everything works together really, really well. And we've been able to pull off some really crazy stuff.
We've been able to do whatever we want speaking like Russell sets up, because Russell and I differ in DMing in that Russell likes to do big set pieces and get you to big set pieces and have things that you can interact with. I'm very much more hippie. I very much more am like, man, get to whatever you get to. So it's been part of stuff that Russell's been able to put together and give us that's really great, including the Rancor bot, which is fantastic.
Because I was like, I really want them to fight a Rancor, but it doesn't make any sense where they're going.
We'll turn it
Rancor
over.
Bot. And Rancor I called bot. It like R4NC0R.
Right, very, very cleverly.
Yeah. So, they still hate me for that. They hate me for that.
I don't. I don't reference you blowing up our ship all that often.
Yeah, let's see. Let's see what I've done. Rancor bot. Rancor. Let's go into the highlights. Rancor bot. I blew up your ship in front of you while it contained a game-breaking amount of credits on board.
Right.
I think that's the one that sticks. Let's see. There was the knockdown drag-out fight between you and the anti-party of, you know, your opposites when you
fought. Yeah.
But that was more of me kind of, I really wanted to tilt as hard as I could.
You gained a lot of information.
I gained a lot of information out of that I can use in designing other games. Because a lot of the way this works is that there are not levels. It's similar to if you've played World of Darkness stuff, where you can purchase ranks and skills, and that's kind of the primary way that you improve your characters. That's the main thing here. You purchase, you know, ranks in primarily. You spend XP to purchase ranks in skills and to improve talents that you have depending on the specialization you've chosen. And you can choose additional specializations to mix and match, even outside of the career, the class that you have chosen. So you can be a bounty hunter. You can start out as a gadgeteer. And then you can decide to pick up some stuff from, like, a medic tree under the colonists, or something from a smuggler tree, if you wanted to be that kind of a guy. Eventually, with Age of Rebellion, you're going to be able to pull possibly, probably, almost certainly, from those talent trees. So if you wanted to be a former pilot who is now a bounty hunter, you could definitely do that. But there are no hard and fast levels, so it's a little difficult to gauge immediately what's strong and what's weak. You know, I can't just go in and say, okay, this is a level 1 threat. That's a level 5 threat. Instead, I have to compare, okay, this person is going to have roughly the same level of training in these skills as the party does. But then, you know, what's the party spending their skills on? How do I keep track of where their baseline power level is? It's hard to say if you have this level of XP cap. If you have 300 points of experience, which is a lot of experience in this game, these should be the threats that you're fighting. You know, these are appropriate threats for these levels of the game. I almost want, in 4th edition, you had heroic games. You had, was it champion tier?
It was heroic, paragon, and epic.
Heroic, paragon, and epic. And I almost want something like that. You know, you are heroes. You are something, and then you are like mythic, you know, something along that level. And then you come in and say, these are heroic challenges. These are mythic challenges. And you get a little bit of that with some of the monsters, but it mostly goes to how they act in combat. You know, you have a nemesis who is a very powerful enemy in combat, which they ran into. And they're meant to be your Boba Fett's and your Darth Vader's. Then you have your regular threats. And then you have your minions, which are like stormtroopers. You have a ton of them. If you have a whole bunch of them, they can be a really big threat. If you have a few of them, you can just start picking them off like crazy. And they do minions in a way that I like way much better, way better than the way that D&D did minions. In that, let's say you have a squad of 5 stormtroopers. I can split them up into 3 and 2. And I can say this group of 3 over here all pools their ability in shooting heavy ranged weapons. So they have 3 ranks because there are 3 of them. And this group over here only has 2 ranks because there's 2 of them. And they kind of work together in fire teams. But at the same time, it's all one big conglomerate of minions that I can keep track of with one stat block. So instead of having to figure out 5 individual attacks, and all 5 of those individual attacks are relatively weak, and oh, the guy with a ton of soak just soaks all of it. Instead, a fire team working together of like 3 minions, 4 minions, 5 minions, can attack and threaten a higher level player the way that a squad of stormtroopers is supposed to. And I really like how that mechanically all starts to work together. Because if I want to scale it, I just put more people in the fire teams or more people in the minion groups, you know?
Right. The issue is, if anyone ever said that Edge of the Empire isn't deadly, that person is wrong. Because you can inadvertently or advertently create threats that are far more powerful than your party should be facing, with like, multiple characters wielding weapons that can one-shot them very easily.
I dropped 2 heavy repeating, like, they're basically e-web blasters. They're anti-personnel big-ass guns that can be used against vehicles, or they can be used against people because they deal that much damage. And I was one-shotting the characters and dropping them
to 3 of the 4 person party.
Yep.
So yeah, that was a little sticky, but it worked out okay.
Yeah.
So at the end of the day, it worked out fine, which is really the thing that really matters the most.
Yeah, I mean, at the same time, you guys were taking them down, they were taking you down. It kind of turned into a bit of a draw.
It didn't. It wasn't a draw. I play a very large character with an axe that kills things. The fact that I was capable of killing the Wookiee practically single-handedly in 2 turns, notwithstanding the fact that, yeah, he died, but no one else really did, without some
without like, some... our sniper was able to snipe the technician that was running the gun on that vehicle.
And then the technician turned around and knocked her out and practically knocked me out.
Well, that was the heavily armed, because I had one of the guys carrying the E-Web like a machine gun, and that was kind of a special case. So it was basically I threw together a hacked kind of monster that was a little strong, strong. So yeah. I'm definitely keeping that in mind as we go forward. You're going to run into him again. Possibly. Probably. Maybe. I don't know. We'll see how I feel.
Yeah, we'll see. But it's been a lot of fun. And if you're not, if you're interested in Star Wars, you like tabletop role playing, the thought of tabletop role playing with Star Wars makes you happy in the pants, you should maybe check it out because it's a great deal of fun.
This sponsorship is brought to you by Art Rotting Erection. Yeah.
It's pretty good.
Yeah.
Another couple of winners that I will be checking out. See, that's the thing about the innies is very few people, unless you're really working in the business, if you don't have a day job or your day job is the business, you know all these. You're like, oh, it's really great that they won. But a lot of these I use as jumping off points for because I respect what the innies produce. There's a book called Shadows of Esterin. That has won a bunch of stuff, and I'm pretty interested in checking it out. So I'm going to I'll be checking it out here once we get off the podcast.
Yeah, and that was actually they actually had a Kickstarter recently that was funded, and holy crap, they made $137,000 on that.
Yeah, well, and it won as far as the innies are concerned, it won Best Interior Art.
That was book one, yes. Shadow of the Esterin, book one.
It won Best Production Values, gold. And it won Product of the Year, silver. Because Paizo won gold.
The NPC Codex.
NPC Codex, yeah.
Yeah, a lot of this is the cream that's risen to the top.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a good way to jump in and start kind of looking around at these different things.
Mm-hmm. But I hadn't really seen a great deal on Shadows of Esterin. And yeah... Successful, $137,000 pledged.
913%.
913%.
And this is for Shadows of Esterin, a medieval horror RPG travels.
Yes, book the zero Ennie was prologue for, is for free.
Yeah, the Ennies were for Shadows of Esterin book one. So that's something that could be worth checking out. Which again, great part of the Ennies.
Yeah, because I basically leave here with a shopping list of stuff I want, like Roll20.
Yeah.
The Crawler's Companion looks really good if you're playing a classic Crawler's game. Super great if you're playing a classic Crawler game. I don't play classic Crawler, so. But if I did, that's the only thing I would need. That's the only thing I would use, especially as a wizard. That's all I would use. That would be it.
Interesting to see Doctor Who stuff on here.
Yeah.
And also interesting. I'm glad to see Shadowrun getting some nods on here too, because. The guy I mentioned earlier, Josh, is a very big Shadowrun fan. Mm-hmm. So Shadowrun, especially the newer editions, is actually something I kind of wanted to look into at some point. Mm-hmm. Especially now that I've got Shadowrun Returns, the Kickstarter video game, which is now out. It was very, very, very successful recreation of that, you know, isometric Neverwinter Nights style. Not fully, but, you know, kind of a mix between that and like Baldur's Gate. Top-down RPG. It's really, really, really good. So I've kind of got the Shadowrun itch again.
I've never played a lot of Shadowrun, but I would be interested in checking it out.
Yeah. Why don't we move into some of the big announcements that came out news-wise? A lot of stuff for D&D from the D&D night that they had, especially concerning D&D Next, as well as for me some really, really cool stuff that I mentioned at the beginning of the podcast for Fantasy Flight Games and X-Wing.
Mm-hmm.
News-wise, D&D, the biggest thing coming out was they talked about the Sundering, which is going to be the big event for the reshaping of Faerun, because they're kind of focusing on Faerun as the first campaign setting for D&D Next whenever it comes out. They also discussed the playtest. The final playtest packet of public playtest distribution will occur in September. They actually just pushed a recent playtest packet for August.
Mm-hmm.
They're going to have a survey on that pretty soon. It's the packet that we've been playing.
Mm-hmm.
And then another playtest packet is going to hit in September, and that is going to be the final public playtest packet. They had, according to Ian World, Morris posted that they had something about the time frame, the launch time frame for D&D Next, but they didn't. In the press release, they mentioned it. But at Gen Con, they did not actually, according to the people who were there, say anything regarding the launch time frame.
Mm-hmm.
They did say that they were going to continue to do internal playtesting after the final release of the public packets. So it does not necessarily mean that you'll see something by Christmas. I would say that it stands, you know, better chance that you're going to see something by early next year. I would think
yeah. Spring of 14, if I were guessing.
Yeah. Other interesting stuff that came out of that. This is the one that I got really excited about because it kind of came out of nowhere. The Lords of Waterdeep board game they're putting on iPad. And you will be able to play that over the internet with other people that have it.
See, that's fun.
Yeah. They're going to have – I know that the expansion, Scoundrels of Skullport, is coming out very shortly.
Mm-hmm. And they were playing it at Gen Con, so yes. It's on the way out, I'm sure.
I would argue that Lords of Waterdeep has kind of become the runaway success of other games coming out of Wizards of the Coast than just – that are D&D-centric but are not specifically the D&D game, mm-hmm. you know? They've tried to do the board game thing with their Ravenloft and the other very D&D style as a board game games. And those have kind of met with some success. You know, I like playing them. There are some issues with them in terms of setting them up, playing them, and getting people involved. It's kind of, you know, you kind of have to deal with that. Lords of Waterdeep has been massively successful, mm-hmm. I think. And Scoundrels of Skullport is just going to add in some really cool stuff to it. So seeing it on iPad is actually really exciting. Even though we just spent a lot of time talking about how crappy certain digital offerings from Wizards of the Coast have turned out to be, you know? But this is being put together by Playdeck Games, so I'm very interested.
If they're shopping it out, that's a good sign.
Oh, yeah.
That's a sign that someone upstairs said, okay, we'll go to somebody who knows what they're doing to create the iPad app. We're going to throw money at it and call it good.
Yep.
Playdeck...
They also had D&D Creo figures announced if you're into that stuff.
Playdeck has produced Agricola, which is a very, very popular German style board game. Flux, the card game in the App Store, which is also extremely popular.
So they've got a good track record of putting board games on apps.
Penny Arcade, the game Gamers vs. Evil. So if Tycho and Gabe are using somebody, they've got to be quality because Penny. Say what you will about Penny Arcade, they also did the Ascension, Storm of Souls. Say what you will about Penny Arcade if you don't find them funny or you think they're blah blah blah. Regardless. They do quality stuff. Even if it's quality stuff you don't like, everything they've done has been quality. So
you may not agree with the way that the guys act. You may not agree with, you know, some of the subject matter, but the quality of the content is still up there.
Yeah, and it's you can't get past it. So they're clearly willing to throw some money at this and make a really kick-ass iPad version of Lords of Waterdeep.
Right.
Which is good.
Fantasy Flight Games, which is, as we said, we kind of carry a torch for a lot of their stuff. I don't know if this was announced specifically at Gen Con, but it's been on their website now since midweek. For Edge of the Empire, they have new talent cards that they're selling. It's about 6 different decks, and these packs of cards basically have the individual talents from your talent tree and your specialization on them. So you can have the card in front of you, and it describes what it does, and you can list the different ranks, and, you know, it does other little things to help you out, which D&D did something similar because they printed the power cards for your class and your like spec that you chose for 4th edition. And there were so many of those that just buying an entire full pack, because I bought them for the Warlord and I think first maybe Paladin. I need to go back and look. But, you know, they were like $15-$20 for this full big pack of cards. And I knew I was only going to use a portion of them because we would never get to a full game, yada, yada, yada. These packs of cards, there's only like 22 cards in them, and they're $7, which I think is a good price point.
It is, especially when you look at how you're going to use your talents. See, trying to create class cards with wizards didn't really work because you're going to produce the cards, and then the next thing that comes out, they're going to be out of date.
Yep.
With these, there are no changes to the talent trees coming. Now, you'll get new talent trees that you can go into, but you're not going to get, because the way D&D works is you go to a level, and at least the way 4th edition worked, which is what these were produced for, you get to a level and you decide what you want to take. Well, if you get more options, then you can decide more things to take. The way this works is much more like a talent tree. If they give you all the cards for the talent tree, then you're going to be able to use all of those cards. They're never going to become... you're not ever going to have a combination of cards and not cards. So creating them for the individual talent trees is a great idea, which allows you to say, I'm going to get this talent and this talent and this talent, and have the cards in front of you so you know what you're doing.
Yep. They are going to be putting out, at the moment, 6 decks that cover the talent, the specializations for two different careers.
Mm-hmm.
For Hired Gun, that's the bodyguard, marauder, and mercenary soldier. For the explorer, that's scout, traitor, and fringer.
Right. So that's actually even better, because you choose one of those, like you choose scout or marauder. You're getting the other two as well. So you're actually getting 3 full talent trees. So if you wanted to stay within, if I wanted to take as a marauder, if I wanted to take a few knocks, a bounty hunter, I could, and I'd have the cards for those.
Yeah. So as we were talking about with the D&D power cards, you know, you had to buy your class and it had all the cards for that class. And then if a new book came out, you had to buy like martial power, the warlord cards specifically for martial power.
Right.
This would be like, if I wanted to be a bravura warlord, I could go out and buy the cards that I needed to play a bravura warlord.
And those cards would always be good.
So that's why I think this is a much better way to do that style of product than what we have seen from other publishers previously. So there's that. If you watch any of the Fantasy Flight Games videos from Gen Con, you also see they have massive stacks of the nice bound Age of Rebellion beta books there, which I wish I could have gotten one of those. There is also, on the X-Wing front, big news coming up. They announced new ways to play campaigns and new formats for play, the epic format and the campaign format. And they also have showed off new ships that are going to be coming early next year, which include, they're basically large ships that go into a much bigger category. The Tantive IV Corellian Blockade Runner, which was the ship that you saw the rebels fleeing in at the beginning of episode 4, A New Hope. You know, that's got the big tube engines on the back of it. It's that. And it's massive. And then you've got the personnel transport, which was used to flee Hoth. So those big kind of long pod-like ships. And those are going to be used, I think, in epic play, and you could potentially use them for campaign play as well, which are going to be different formats aside from what you would normally see in a store like normal play. Because the way the game works, you have a point total that you build your fleet with, and if you play a certain type of game, then you have a certain point total, like 100 points or 60 points. Epic games, I think, are going to be like 1,000 points or, you know, 2,500 points or something like that. And you'll be able to field massive fleets of ships. So, like, you could have a blockade runner, the Tantive IV, and you could have, you know, an actual wing of X-Wings, like 6 X-Wings, and you're flying against an entire squadron of TIE pilots that are all swarming your ship. And that would be a possible example of what you'd see in epic play.
Mm-hmm.
The blockade runner is going to cost $90. The personnel transport is going to cost $60. So these are only for very serious collectors and players, or if you're running a shop, for instance, and you want to be able to provide these for people to play at your shop. You could buy those and use those. So I imagine that just like some of the other ships have gone out of stock very quickly, and their prices on Amazon have shot up. I think that you could see the same thing happen with these, because they're probably not going to be making them to the extent that – to the quantity and volume that they're making X-Wings and TIE Fighters, which people really need to buy in bulk, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Campaign play is going to be – you have several different types of scenarios that you undertake that are – they describe them as like asymmetrical scenarios. So like you're, you know, trying to escort this ship, very similar to the games that you saw in the back of the X-Wing miniatures game book that described like transport this senator,
mm-hmm.
steal these satellites, you know. But it's going to be specific scenarios that then lead into a full campaign arc played out over several different games. So you could be, for instance, possibly Rogue Squadron, going out and playing as Rogue Squadron, trying to deal with these multiple levels of threats. And then I think maybe your consequences could stretch from game to game. You know, that sounds like a pretty interesting way to bring beyond just, you know, you have your ships, I have my ships, and pew, pew, pew. You can actually bring more Star Wars story into the game itself, and could draw more people interested in that kind of play to a shop or to play with other people, instead of people that are just there to play a tournament style game, you know?
So I'm thinking, because I talked about on the last podcast, we talked about the difficulty of ship to ship combat,
yep.
in Edge of the Empire.
Yeah,
maybe figure out a way to put the two of them together.
A lot of people have been talking about that ever since they first announced X-Wing and Edge. They're like, you know, is there a way that we're going to be able to incorporate these two things together? So
I honestly, from what I've seen, I think you could do it yourself if you're smart enough.
Oh, yeah. I mean, if you have, for instance, a YT-1300 and you have a bunch of TIE fighters, then you could use those just on a map to represent mm-hmm. you're here, you're doing this. Whereas they're just miniatures at that point. So,
well, I mean, why couldn't you actually use the rules for the game and come up with your own scenario, which is get this far, or, you know, get out of range of the whatever, or destroy all of the other TIE fighters, just like you would in your Edge of the Empire game?
Yeah, the only issue that you run into there is, how do your in-game skills and specialization Exactly.
They wouldn't. It would just be...
You just have to let your you know, you have to have a group that would be like, oh yeah, absolutely.
Or you could figure out, you know, you might be able to figure out a way to... I'm not as up on the... Well, yeah, I've seen the tabletop video. You could maybe give bonuses here and there, things like that, based on skills. I'm sure you could come up with, like, sort of a conversion chart that would allow you to do that. But it's something to think about.
Yeah, I know a lot of people have been, you know, talking about that on the forums for Fantasy Flight Games, and so there's almost certainly different hacks floating around for people who have found ways to do that.
I am sure.
The really, especially with the large ships, the one thing that's hanging on my mind, though, is that they have not announced or shown any large ships for the Imperials. All they've shown have been Rebel ships, a blockade runner, a transport, and those are, you could say, well, those are generic enough craft that you could use them for the Imperials. You're not going to see an Imperial flying a YT-1300. You're going to see, you know, an Imperial flying a TIE fighter,
mm-hmm.
or they'll be flying a Lambda shuttle, or they'll be flying the iconic ships that are known mm-hmm. for being Imperial. I think that they've got other ships up their sleeve.
Oh, I know they do. They're going to continue to put them out. I mean, if they're coming out with a blockade, runner that's $90,
yeah,
you know they're going to come out with a Star Destroyer. You know they're going to come out with part of a Death Star.
See, it would be nice if they did, but my concern is, how do you handle the scale on that level? Because to this point,
well, here's the thing. You could come out with, and just try to stay with me, you could come out with a part of, let's say you wanted a Death Star. You come out with a part of the Death Star. It's not the full Death Star. It's the part of it.
Like, they've got maps that are, you know, the background looks like the Death Star, so you're flying over and around the Death Star.
Mm-hmm.
But it's so big, you know? You'd almost have to abstract it entirely. You can't have the Death Star, which is the size of a planet, moving around on a mat that also has to accommodate regular ships. Otherwise, you get so big that, you know, essentially at that point you're playing...
Or you come out with a map, just like you're talking about, that has the Death Star on it, and then you come out with features of the Death Star that stick out of the map. Like, yeah, turrets and things like that.
See, I could see specific scenarios. You know, the Death Star works for that kind of thing. My issue, if you're looking at kind of ship-to-ship scale with, say, a Star Destroyer versus a Corellian Corvette, is that in A New Hope, you saw the Tantive IV get eaten, essentially. They got tractor-beamed into the hold and the docking bay underneath an Imperial-class Star Destroyer, which means that the ship was small enough that it could fit inside the Star Destroyer.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if they keep that same scale, that's going to be a Star Destroyer the size of a folding table. So they've already said that they're going to have to kind of monkey with some of the scale, because the Corellian Corvettes are also, you know, large enough that X-Wings could, say, dock with them and in them. You know, the X-Wings, if you look at the pictures that they had showing them off, they said, you know, the large ships are not necessarily going to match the same exact 1-270, whatever the scale is, that the X-Wings are at. So they're going to have to play with it a little bit. I just, because there was such a size disparity between those size ships, I don't know if they're going to just hand wave it and say, Star Destroyer, here you go. And they could call it a Victory class, which are tend to be a bit smaller. Or they could call it a something else. Or if they pick an entirely different ship, you know? That's kind of what I'm interested to see is what happens next. I think that you're going to see a Star Destroyer because it's the most iconic ship.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that it's just going to wind up being the same size as the Blockade Runner. And then later, you're going to see them introduce a Mon Cal Cruiser, and it's going to be about the same size. It will comparatively, from a model standpoint, look just like and be a scaled-down version of those big ships, but they're just going to have to be roughly the same size on the board for gameplay purposes so that you can have capital ships on the game, you know? So I don't know.
I'm not gonna say that we're not gonna see parts of ships. I think you could see parts of ships that would look really cool.
Yeah, and like later, I would love to see like Home One and the Executor, Executor, the Super Star Destroyer, and the massive, you know, main Mon Cal ship from the Battle of Endor, and to have the possibility to recreate that with like 3 Star Destroyers and a Super Star Destroyer, 4 Corellian Corvettes and Home One, and then, you know, you have different players that are all working together, like 3 players. One of them is kind of the Fleet Admiral overseeing it. One of them is controlling the Star Destroyers. One of them is controlling like 5 groups of TIE Fighters. And then on the other side of the table, and this table would probably be like 2 folding tables side by side, that big. That's the level of play that I think people look at and they're like, that I want to see. And that I will pay money to see happen. So if we get to that point,
hey,
then that's going to be something to see.
I mean, it's if there's any fandom that would do something like that,
it is this fandom.
It's Star Wars. Yeah.
It is absolutely this fandom.
Anyway, we are definitely out of time. Stay up to date with Gen Con by hitting up their website or going to one of the many Gen Con news sites that we've also gone through. As always, our music is Out Prop featuring Esset. Check them out on uhort.no. Check us out on Twitter. We are at GIR Podcast. You can also shoot us an email to girpodcast@gmail.com. For Russell, this is Jeremy. Thanks for listening.
May the Force be with you, except for that guy, because he is a dick.